So let's go to James chapter 1. We have been slowly making our way through this text. But we're in verse 12. And I think if you had an opportunity to read James again this week, what continues to stand out to me is the simplicity of what he's writing, yet how important and significant it is for us to learn from. Last week, we were looking at those prior verses. We talked about some key terms, one of those being faith. That word faith is going to come up over and over again. It's important throughout the text. And what James says to us about how we demonstrate faith, what is biblical faith? And of course, as we move forward later in this chapter, and especially in chapter in chapter 3, we'll talk again about faith and how he outright says to us, you know, what it looks like to be faithful to God. So, last week we were talking about wisdom and its connection with faith and in prayer. And then we ended the class in verses 9 through 11, where we talked about, this act of humility that's necessary for those who have been given so much materially, how God expects them to not glory in their gifts, but to take humility in that those things are going to pass away, but with time, yet we should take glory in that we're children of God. So let's go to verse 12. And I'm going to read 12 through 15, and then we'll dig into each of these verses. But so verse 12, he says, "Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I'm being tempted by God,' for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, gives birth to death." So he's going to talk about two different concepts, and I don't want to confuse them. All right, so there's a more broad concept of trial and a more narrow concept of temptation. We should not confuse those two. So as just kind of a way to wade into this, when we're talking about trial, how does that contrast with temptation? How are they different?
Okay.
Oh, got a few there. We'll Miss Regina and then Lisa, then we'll go back to Doug. Go ahead, Miss Jean. You want? I'll call somebody else if you don't. Okay. Lisa, what are you going to say?
It seems like one of them is something that can produce sin, and a trial is like a hardship.
Okay.
But I don't know.
No, that's pretty good. We're going to go in on that a little bit further, Doug. So, go ahead, Ms.
I was thinking there's two ways to look at it, from a consequence perspective, as well as, like, consequence and more of a, like, the purpose.
Okay.
So, with the purpose, temptation, both of them, trials and temptations they have more of a, like a pruning type effect, whereas the consequences is very clear. One of them, Charles is like to refine, and the temptation will be more like, it has the outcome of death, like a life and death kind of.
Okay. We'll explore these a little bit more. So the way I think James is using the word trial here is, and one of the contrasting ideas is, whereas trials can either be internal or external, right? They can come from either the internal or the external. Temptations are internal, right? It's us, right? We'll get to that later in verses 13 and 14 when he talks about where temptation comes from. And it is from ourselves. Whereas trials are often things that happen to us and not us happening, not us creating. Now, we can bring trials on ourselves out of our temptation, but trials do not necessarily lead to sin, although they can weaken because we're not wanting to endure trial, we can sin, but that comes more out of temptation. So, there is not that progression in trials like you see in temptation. And so that's one of the big things here. We're not in a trial. It's something we are enduring, right? Something we are going through. And you notice in verse 12, he said, blessed is what kind of man? The one who remains steadfast under trial. So you think about that word under. You ever been in a cave system before? Any kind of cave system? Am I the only one?
Yes.
Some of us have, right? You can shake your head, nod, raise your hand or something. Let me know. Caves, I'm claustrophobic. It's one of my things, right? And, you know, you get inside a cave and what's going on? Well, you have this opening in this mountain or you know, into the rock, and you're going in there, and tunnels can be all kinds of different shapes and sizes as you go through. My biggest concern in the world is that cave's going to cave in, right? And when it does, you're going to be under a lot of pressure, right? Pressure does what? It can make diamonds, but it can also crush, right? Depending on what's going on, it can either harden us, harden our resolve, or it can crush us and destroy us. And so you think here, when we go through trials, maybe it's a health issue, maybe it's a family situation, maybe it's a work thing. Trials come at us from all different directions. We will all be under trial. Really, when it comes to our Christian walk, it is how we respond to them. And just because we're in trial doesn't mean there's any sin on our behalf that created it. Like I said, most of the time it's probably external. But it is what we do with those trials, what we allow it to do in our lives. He says the person who can endure, stay steadfast, is the person who will be rewarded. He calls it here, for when he has stood the test of what?
Of a trial.
Test of his faith. It's a faith test. Will I continue to rely on God, or am I going to rely on myself? And there's a test in that. He says, the one who remains faithful in that will receive the crown of life. But that only comes after we've went through the trial. And ultimately, that is referencing the trial of life completely. And he says, he adds this promise at the end. He says, which God has promised to those who love him. And who are those who love him? Who is that group of people? The ones who've obeyed, the ones who've remained steadfast. If I'm looking directly at this text, as he's using it. It's the ones who have been under trial. They've been pressed down. It's pressing down on them, yet they don't give up. They don't give in. They allow the pressure to not crush them, but it helps to harden their faith. Not their heart, but it hardens their faith. And it makes it more solid, more reliant and trusting on God. It's those who have that hope of promise of the crown of life. And so when we face trial, one of the things we must keep in view is all of this we're going through has an ultimate end to it. And if we remain faithful, it has a good end for us. And so trials are going to come. The question is how do we deal with them? Then we go into verse 13. So we're going to make the transition from trial and talk about temptation and how they're different. Go ahead.
Just a question on that verse, related to one you used this morning, 2 Corinthians 13. There it says, examine yourself, see if you're in the faith. Mm-hmm. I've heard it said, but it basically, if you're not having trials, then Satan's not worried about you because you're not really living right.
Yeah.
If you're having trials, then that, Satan's probably concerned because you're actually trying to live a Christian life. You're actually trying to grow and develop your character toward God and all that. So would you put those two together at all like that to say they apply together?
Yeah, I would just add one caveat. One caveat. Just because you're going through trials doesn't mean you're righteous, right? But those who are righteous will suffer under trial. All men, righteous or unrighteous, suffer trial. But if you find yourself never suffering, maybe you ought to ask what's going on, right? But we're all tested. And when we're not under trial, when things are going well, that's the time to get ready for the trials that will come. Because it will come. It will happen to all of us eventually. And so let's go to verse 13. So he says, let no one say when he is tempted. Now, this is a different word in the original language. This isn't the same one used in verse 12. This idea is more directed toward temptation. It's not as broad a term. He says, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. I talk about temptation. So let's define our term. What when we use the term, when James uses the term, what is he intending? What's the intended meaning of temptation? There's a clue later. I hate to steal from myself, but I'm going to go down to verse 14. You really need to read verse 14 to get it. But each person is tempted, let me put it up there, when he is lured and enticed, how? By his own desire. So we go back and we think about that verse in connection with the previous verse. So how are we defining what it means to be tempted? What is a temptation?
When you have an inner desire to do something that doesn't please God.
Okay. Okay. Miss Becky, did you? Okay. Are all temptations bad?
No.
Are they all bad? Okay, Miss Regina. What about the rest of everybody? Are all temptations bad? Sorry.
I
didn't
eat another piece of cake at lunch, but I didn't.
Well,
I was tempted to eat another piece of cake at lunch, but I didn't.
You endured the temptation. I wonder what God's escape was. We'll look at that in just a minute. But not all temptation's bad, right? There's a such thing as good peer pressure. right? There are times when we're tempted to do the good thing. Temptation is just this idea of desire. It's an internal longing or lure. It's something that I think the significant thing is it's internal, like it's within us. It's in our minds. That's where it begins. The initiation of any temptation comes from within us, from within our being. You take a young man on a beach, and he sees something he shouldn't see, right? There are all kinds of individuals out there dressed all kinds of ways. And he looks. When does the temptation begin? It begins with a thought, right? The thought crystallizes an evil thought in this occasion towards something that's not pure and not holy, something that's not upright. Now, he was, what, lured into that. The boys the other night, they had a squirrel trap. And they had put some peanut butter or something inside of there. They were trying to do what? Entice an animal. And I asked them, I said, well, when you get one in there, what are you going to do with it? My son said, I'm going to eat it. I was like, what kitchen are you cooking it in? But, you know, that they're hoping to entice, to lure, right, something in a squirrel inside that cage. Well, that's the way temptation works. It's a hook, right? Something that grabs our attention and our desire. And so when desire is created within us, that is the beginning of temptation. And so before I get to 14, I want to finish up with 13 here. So before he gets into the real reason for temptation, he does debunk one bad idea, which is what? What's the point of 13? A lot of good answers there. What'd you say, Doug? God is not the source. That's why it disheartens me so much when I hear people say things like, well, this is the way God created me. God does not create us for evil. Temptation, as we're going to learn, is an internal thing with us. It's our desires. He does not set us up for temptation. Man is made in the image of God. And what God gives us is free will. He allows us to make a choice. When Adam and Eve were placed by God in the garden, God did not put it in them to sin. God warned them. Where did that sin come from? From within them. It wasn't something external. But it was a desire that bore itself in the mind of Eve when she looked at the fruit. Do you remember what it says in Genesis 3? What did she do? What's the first thing she did? She looked. And what did she notice? It looked pretty, right? It's attractive. And no, it probably wasn't an apple. She looked at it. It was desirable. And then what? What else did it say she did? She said it was good for food. I bet it would taste good. Although she has no idea how it would taste, does she? But she desired it. And so she assumed, oh, it would taste good. And that it would make one wise. And so she was lured into that temptation, not by God. That came from within her. And she gave it to her husband, and he ate as well. And so James is debunking the idea that God made me do it. He didn't create me toward a mind to sin. He gave me free will to make choices in my life. And so we're not born with a nature towards sin. You know, there's a popular doctrine that's being taught in some places that we're born in sin. No, we're not. We're not even born with a nature to sin. Sin is a choice we make. And he goes on to make that pretty plainly in the next two verses. In verses 14 and 15. So he ends it this way. He himself tempts no one. So God can't be tempted by evil, nor does he lead us into temptation. You remember the prayer in Psalm 23? What does he say? Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from... That's Psalm 23. Huh? I'm sorry. I did confuse that. That's the prayer, that's the example prayer in Matthew 6. How did I get Psalm 23? Thank you for correcting me. It's Matthew 6 when the apostles ask, teach us how to pray. And part of that prayer is he's asking God, do not lead us. Now, is he saying God would lead them into temptation? What was the point of that phrase? Protect me from it. Protect me from myself.
But he does say he will test, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he left some of the people in the land back in Old Testament stuff to test the people, right? To see if they would choose his way, be faithful to him. They didn't, to me at least, they didn't make a wholehearted attempt to drive them out, but still.
Yeah.
There are some passages that talk about testing us to see what our decision will be. We can choose my way or we can choose your own.
Again, it's that free will idea that God gives us free will, an opportunity to make our own choices. So let's move to the next two verses here. So he goes down in 14 and he talks about the real place of sin. And he says, but each person is tempted how or when? When he is lured and enticed by his own desires. Right, that's internal. And then 15, desire, when it has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. It's interesting, he uses this maturation timeline, right? Conception, birth, growing up, maturity. And he uses that as a symbolic way to talk about the creation of sin in our lives. Where does it come from? Well, it begins in the heart with desire. When we give in to that desire, we choose to do that evil act. In that moment, we have committed sin in our lives. And then ultimately, if we allow sin to mature in us, if we allow sin to mature, what's going to happen? We're going to die. And of course, the death he's talking about here is not physical death. He's talking about spiritual death and the ultimate reality of it, being lost forever in hell. So we see the chain of sin and death. But does God leave us alone in all of that?
No, thank you, Jesus.
Yeah, so if we go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, this is a really well-known verse, and we use it a lot. But what does it say to us, 13? First Corinthians 10:13. Yeah, so God will not do what? So what does that first part, before we get to the escape, what does that first part imply?
That we're not tempted any more than we can stand, that we can help us.
So anytime we say, I can't help myself, it's a lie we tell ourselves. That's a lie because... He says, he promises us that you can endure your temptations. You can overcome them. And so we need to keep that in mind. And he also says that these are what? Common to man. Again, your sin, it has particular characteristics about it, your temptations about your life, but it's not unique in the grand scheme of things. It's not. There are others who suffer. There are others who endure the same kind of temptations. And then he gives us the hope. He says that he gives us a what? A way to escape. I think about Paul himself. You remember he's in the city and they're after him. And what do they end up doing? They lower him down in the basket through the wall, right? When he didn't know how God was going to get him out of there, if he was, God provided an escape. God will provide us a way of escape. Now, we talk about that term. That's a very broad kind of idea. But what does it mean, escape? That you may be able to endure it. A means of resistance. What was that?
I was thinking along the line of Brother Doug, like just encouragement from my brothers and sisters, and with that encouragement, you know, it helps us to change our perspective. So if my brother has gone through something and God, you know, delivered him or whatever, I'm sorry to use you as an example, but you know, if God can change things in his life or whatever that temptation is, he can do it for me. So I was in agreement with you, Brother Doug, that encouragement from each other.
Mm-hmm. And the text also says God will go ahead, Lisa, and I'll say
this. Well, maybe another path.
Okay.
We were talking about adultery, and it's, you know, sometimes we like to get, you know, you were talking about the beach and everything like that. Well, maybe if we know that that's a temptation for us, maybe we shouldn't go in that direction to even begin with, so not even go into that path.
I always think, what if David went on to war and led his army to battle? He would never have seen Bathsheba. He would have been somewhere else. But he was on that roof at a time of day when he shouldn't have been up there, looking in a place he shouldn't have been looking. Here's one other thing, though. It says God will provide a way of escape. That doesn't mean, he's not saying he's going to escape me. He's not going to get behind me and push me into the escape. He provides a way, but I have to take the initiative. Right? If I have a temptation, this one just works. I don't know, it's similar to the last one, but it works in my head. Is if you've got something going on at work and you're married and you've got a coworker that you're attracted to and you talk to, and that's going in a direction it shouldn't go, what's God's way of escape? Well, I don't know, but yes, you have got to be proactive in making change in your life. If we keep falling in the same sin all the time, where's the problem?
Sometimes they can get loaded down at work. The shift their attention. Sometimes that could be a way of escape.
Mm-hmm. But you need to find your way of escape.
Do like Joseph did. Leave his coat.
And you know, he got out of there, right? And like in that scenario, maybe you gotta go find another job. But we can't expect it to be okay for us just to keep making the same mistake and God be okay with that. He provides us a way of escape with the intention of what? You take the escape. You're in a burning building. And you know there's an exit on the other side that you always like to go out of. But there's an exit over here. You refuse this exit to try to get to the other one. Whose fault is it if you get burned up? It's your fault. God, they provided an exit for you. We have to be realistic about our own desire and our own temptation. Because ultimately, and we'll stop here in verse 15, ultimately, we need to keep eternity in view. When sin is fully grown in our lives, it brings forth death. I know death is a broad term, and we can use it in a very broad way, but ultimately, when we're considering reality of things, physical death is going to come to us all. But the one, and we can't avoid it unless Jesus comes back, right? But one thing we do have a way to avoid is eternal death. God's provided a way of escape by sending His own Son to bear the guilt, or to bear the consequences of our guilt. What about our lives? Are we doing what we need to in order to overcome our temptations? Next week, we'll go on and look at 16 and 17 and following. He'll go back to looking at God and where good things actually come from. So we'll pick that up. Any other questions or comments before we close?
Brother, I have a comment.
Yes, ma'am.
I think the one thing that we as saints forget to remember when we are being tempted is 1 John, the first chapter and the 9th verse. If you confess your sin, and James is going to talk about that later on, by us confessing our weaknesses to each other, because the prayers of the righteous availeth much. And I do believe, that I know from experience, that that is a way out. If I confess my weakness to my brothers and to my sister, I know I did that a whole lot when I was coming out of the world 23 years ago, because I had a problem with drinking and bad language, all of that. And I took that verse to heart. I confessed it, my sin, and He is faithful and He is just to forgive us. And not just that, but He cleanses us from that sin.
And He also provides us a support group behind us, so that, and it's all support, but it's also a way to check ourselves. For those that we are talking to look in on us and say, hey, how are you doing? And so we need to take advantage of that. Anything else? Good. Do you have something, Doug?
Just the other side of her thing. We who may not be that person need to make ourselves available to those kind of people to be used.
Oh, yeah. Are we approachable? Right.
Yeah. I mean, for us as a group, though, we have to be available to our brothers and sisters to help in that regard. Sometimes we make ourselves, and we're not helping them.
And we'll close on that thought, but that doesn't happen overnight. Nobody's going to come to you as a confidant and a trusted brother or sister that I can share this with if that's the first conversation you ever had. Right? People need to show you, demonstrate love prior to that. And then they may be more willing to trust you. So we do need to be available for people. Good thoughts. Well, we'll go ahead and close there.